Hello, friends. Good to see you. Everybody's coming in. I have a feeling we're going to have a number of new members here today and veteran members. And let me just say, it is my honor and privilege and delight to introduce to you my colleagues and friends, Dr. Susan Baum and Dr. Dan Peters. I really can't think of two more highly qualified people to answer your questions about bright and quirky kids. Susan will be answering questions about bright and quirky twice exceptional education. And Dan will be answering questions about mental health. Susan is the chancellor of the Bridges graduate program. You guys probably heard of the Bridges School now. It's her brainchild, pretty much. And Dr. Dan is the executive director of the Summit Center in the Bay Area. I think it's like the best place I could send people for a neuropsych. And he does the Parent Footprint podcast. So how are you guys doing? You want to do a quick check-in? What's new?
So busy. Always more to do. We've been working a lot on refining our what we mean by strength-based, talent-focused teaching and learning, and really trying to support parents with those strength-based IEPs, and giving parents a more positive voice that they can have when they go to that meeting. And the word for today is two words, invisible accommodations. Good
Ooh.
classrooms offer good teaching and learning to everyone, so accommodations can become invisible. Plus, so many of our kids get embarrassed when they are singled out for an accommodation. But if teachers just could give some choices and do Because our accommodations just are good teaching. Teachers should be doing it. So that's my phrase for today. Invisible
I love it.
accommodation.
Sue, we haven't even started the questions and you're dropping the knowledge bombs. I love it. Okay.
Truth.
Dan, what's new in your world?
We are starting a free webinar series, which starts this Wednesday, next Wednesday. I'm kicking it off with a talk on parenting with purpose, awareness, and intention. And other ones in the lineup for people to keep their eye on. The next one is one on autism with Dr. Lisa Hancock. And then we have one on teen 2E gifted and 2E teenage intensity, talking about dating, relationships, and sex with this population with Dr. Lisa White. Dr. Jeannie Lopez is going to do one on neurodiversity and medically complex individuals. As we all know, we see that a lot. And then we also have one, Dr. Jenny Ritchie is going to do one on anxiety, and we're just going to keep rolling them out as an offer to our community. And if
Oh my gosh, I love it.
Oh,
So
come on.
it's on the bottom of our website. If you're on our list, you'll get the blast, but it's on the bottom of our website, the events, and anyone who signs up will get the free recording if they don't can't make it live. They're going to be
Fabulous.
Wednesdays at noon.
Great. We're
Pacific
doing
Coast
a similar topic this month. We're doing love, lust, and dating while neurodivergent with Ari
Time.
Tuckman. So
Nice.
we got the mind meld. We're
We are
syncing, Dan.
aligned. We are aligned.
Right, fantastic. We have a lot of questions today. We're gonna dive right in and succinctly answer your questions. And at the very end, time permitting, I'm gonna show new members the very cool thing Casey does with all these questions, where you can click on your question and go right to the answer in the replay. All right. Let's go ahead and get started. The first question is for Dr. Dan. What are ways to help bright and quirky kids understand that they do not need to have the last word or always correct errors made by others. My 8-year-old gets extremely frustrated when other kids make factually inaccurate statements, which leads to extra conflict and difficulties maintaining friendships.
Yeah, this is a real one and a good one. My first question for reflection is how many of us adults need to get the last word as well, because it does run with this population of people. So that's just something to think about. A quick story: when we were doing Camp Summit before COVID, in one of our teen groups, this issue came up about, in particular, correcting teachers. And half it was co-ed teen group, and the question was, if a teacher makes a mistake, do you correct them or not? And half the group said, absolutely, it's you cannot let a falsehood, when it's their job or someone's giving information, it is my obligation to the truth and for factual accuracy. And the other half was like, yeah, but you know, there are some consequences to that if you do this. So it was great debate. And this is the issue. So I think in these situations, it's one thing if your child has to have the last word with you. That just might be kind of the dynamic, and you might even be willing to let that go if you can disengage from the argument or the conversation. When it comes to social, this is where I talk about helping kids understand how the world works. That's the quote. Here's how the world works. And this is where you educate them about, first of all, validate the why they feel the need, because gifted and twice exceptional kids have the strong social justice, the strong inclination and drive for truth. So we want to honor that and respect that and appreciate that. And then also tell them how the world works. When you correct friends and correct teachers and correct adults, it usually is not met well when people feel publicly humiliated or shamed. And then you could tell them, you know, that's, I'm sure that's not your intention, but how do you feel when people correct you publicly, whether you're right or wrong? So, which we're trying to, instead of stop it, we're trying to give information, because these kids over time and with experience can start to incorporate this as they mature.
Yes, praise in public, correct in private. All right, Sue, next one's for you. My 9-year-old boy avoids schoolwork, we homeschool, anytime he perceives it is out of his skill set, even if it's not, and he becomes dysregulated. I struggle with getting him to endure through the assignments and need advice on how to get him to understand that he can do it.
I'm just working with a little boy all weekend on, something must have happened in school where he's feeling really dumb. And there's a long answer to a short question here. I asked him what would be the perfect school for him. And he described this school, and he says kids would come to school and they'd have choice. They'd go out and play all day, then come back at the end of the day outside of the playground, and then they could watch a video and a movie. And, you know, I'm thinking, so we said, well, I said to him, he says, you know, you're free to do what you want. I said, what would you call this school? He says, freedom school. And I realized, I said, well, where would the lessons be? Well, there wouldn't be any. Something is happening to our kids when they're not being successful in a lesson. When they're feeling like they can't do it, or somebody else can do it better, and they just are shutting down. They don't seem to be emotionally available to learn. And so I'm just wondering if for a while it's more of an unschooling without the word lesson, without teaching formally, and letting them know they can do all these things, but they didn't even know it was a lesson. Because I asked them, well, what if you're outside playing and you want to learn about rockets and you're on a swing and the rocket's taking off? Well, that's different, he says. That's very different. And then we know he likes music. I said, what if there was music lessons in the classroom? Oh, that's different. But I am telling you, we've got to be a little sneaky when there's something about a lesson that's triggering them to, I'm not going to participate. So we've got to go through the back door a little bit. And then later on say, gee, you learned a lot. You actually can do this. It's not just one way to do a lesson. Let's be creative. You're muted, I think.
Whoops. Okay. Yep. We got to sneak past that amygdala. All right. Dan, my son has experienced a lot of peer rejection and now just approaches kids by comparing himself to them. For example, how tall are you? How many basket shots did you get? He pushes away the potential to make friends by wanting to present himself as the biggest and best.
Yeah, this is not uncommon, and it's really hard when you are faced with sort of constant or chronic social rejection. So you're trying to find a way in. I think first off, I'm thinking about the resilience in him continuing to go back instead of just rolling up and isolating. So, that's strength in there. And then I go back to similarly to what I said before. I think it's a conversation again about how the world works and validating his efforts and his resilience and trying to help him understand that how he might going about it might be seen as one-upping other people and that people don't usually like that. But he also needs some skills. So it'd be practicing other ways to interact, like role play with him, or here's some things you can ask, here's some questions, here's how you can listen, and then try to add something to the conversation. But it's to me, it's validating the intent and then helping him with the execution in a way that might be more effective. And again, it's sensitive because he's going to be very sensitive to this, clearly. So it's just being mindful of that and trying to wait for the right time and trying to execute it in a way where maybe you're not having a serious conversation. I've been thinking, maybe you're on a walk, maybe you're in the car, and you might have to drop a little bit and come back to it later if it's not being received.
Yeah, I was watching a little video online and the person was describing the line of cringe. Like, it's okay to feel like proud about your accomplishments, but does it get a little cringy when you say in public, I'm the best, whatever? And, that might be a really abstract concept for a lot of kids. Like, where's the line of cringe?
A line of cringe. I like
Line of cringe. Yeah.
that. I love that.
Yes.
All right. Not sure which of you want to take this one. My 10-year-old struggles with slow processing speed, impacting learning and social interactions. What are the most effective interventions, therapies, strategies, etc., for school and home to improve these areas? Are medications ever an option for this age group? And if so, what are the potential benefits and drawbacks?
How old?
10.
10. I'll just jump in on that first medicine part. I mean, this is a tough one. Processing speed is something that I think all of our allied fields have been trying to figure out for a while, and how much of it is just part of the wiring and how much of it can be improved. Few things that we've noted over time that processing can increase with maturity and with brain development over time. Again, that's the slower way. And medicine does help, can help. Medicine can help, like the stimulant medicines that are often used with ADHD. It generally improves processing speed, but not necessarily globally. It doesn't mean if you have visual motor processing speed and you have dysgraphia that it's just going to increase it. But what people, part of the processing challenges that people describe is that when there's all of this stuff coming at them and it's hard to sort them and distract them, it's harder to encode and come up with a response. And for people who are on the ADHD spectrum who have positive responses to stimulant medicine, they describe all of a sudden it's just streamlined. Like they can pick what they're focusing on and they can, they can receive it and then they can output it. In terms of I know occupational therapists now have more and more computer-based programs for processing, but I can't speak to them directly. Sue?
I'm glad you answered because I don't think I could answer. I'd rather say how you might support that so that if you know what's going to be discussed in class that next day, that you come prepared with that kind of information so that you've already talked about it once, you already reviewed it. The teacher could share a slideshow at home, so you already know what it's going to be about, and you so that when you hear it again, you don't have to go search for it. You've already rehearsed it, and you can, and the, you know, you overcome, or you've already, it's not the first time you've experienced whatever that discussion is. So I think that's how we can scaffold this. And I think you have to think about giving those kids fewer, less work in school. So they could, it doesn't going to take them that long to write one paragraph versus write five paragraphs. And I think we can, we need to be flexible in how we do school to support that slow processing speed. Even, perhaps as they get older or they become more expert in a topic, we know that the more expert and the more knowledgeable you get in an area, we know that your working memory improves. And if the working memory improves, the processing speed will be positively impacted. So, it's practice over time.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful. Okay, Dan, I have a 13-year-old son that exhibits Asperger's tendencies. Looking for advice on if I should have him tested for ASD or maybe start with some therapy with someone with ASD expertise. He's already in therapy, but with a non-ASD expert who doesn't think he is ASD. However, she's actually never met him in person.
Okay, there's two prongs here which are highlighted. One is evaluation for understanding and clarity and planning. And another one is therapy for actual intervention. So both can be important, and we can start with one or the other or both at the same time. So for example, if, for example, this ASD possible ASD ASPE profile, social skills and social awareness is a challenge that would be important to work on, right? So that therapist, we would want them to have that. We'd want them to have knowledge in the area of ideally the profile, but at least the actual area that's needed for intervention and skill building. If one is concerned or one is wanting to know about whether this profile fits to be for parenting, for schooling, and for ultimately more self-knowledge for your child when the time is right, evaluation is the way for that. It is the way to get a baseline of where your child falls on these areas so you don't have to guess, and you can actually see. And for a lot of these, it can be gray for a lot of these kids, especially these gifted, highly gifted kids who have some social quirks, some sensory challenges, and have some Asperger's or autism symptoms and characteristics. And a lot of the interventions or supports could be similar. The difference being is like, is it or is it not in the sense to the degree that we can know? And then how much then extra do we need to do? Do we need to talk to the school? Do we, do you need any, are there more sensory issues than you had thought? So, I'm obviously a proponent of evaluations, but I'm also very pragmatic. So if you have a good therapist and you think you can hold off on spending the time and the money to get those answers, then that's a fine thing to do too. I imagine you have to think about you'll still be going to, at some point, an evaluation is very likely in these situations. It's usually needed at some point. So it's a question of how proactive or how ahead of it you might want to
Right.
be or wait.
Yeah. And how much is it getting in the way of daily living?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Excellent. Sue, when considering grade acceleration, what key factors do you feel are most important to consider? And is there a grade level that you feel is the best time to accelerate or any other advice? I've got a bright and quirky provisional autism, ADHD, exacerbated, controlled by anxiety, selective mutism, 7-year-old in second grade. At school, he's anxious, quiet, and very compliant, but hates going and complains of boredom. Let me just say that was like a very succinctly worded question. Thank you.
So you want a succinctly worded answer.
Bingo.
Yeah. First of all, you want to go to the information at the Iowa Bell and Blank Center. They are the done all the research on. There are about 27 different kinds of acceleration. It isn't just grade skipping. It's what it could be by content area. It could be for part of the school day. It could happen in the second grade classroom, and they go to the fifth grade classroom for reading. And so there's many different kinds, and there's an acceleration scale to see if they are a good candidate for any one of these types of acceleration. What I like to say, if it's grade skipping and they end up in the third grade or the fourth grade, I try to decide in what grade level are most of their needs met? If they happen to have friends in the second grade and they're comfortable in that second grade and they're not anxious, but they need harder work, then maybe I could give them harder work and stay in the second grade. But if the second grade doesn't have peers that are at the same intellectual level, if there's a lot of anxiety in that classroom, they would be better served by being with older kids because they get along with older kids. The curriculum is at their grade level, then I would say skip them. There's no particular grade that's better than another. You need to identify what are their instructional levels? Where are they in reading and in math? And how much can they produce if you wanted to see which grade level they fit better?
Okay, excellent. Very interesting. Dan, my newly 9-year-old son has begun lying a lot. It's always obvious, and usually I just say, huh, we move on. But every now and then it bumps up against reality, and I have to press a little, and this does not go well with his PDA-ness. What's really going on here?
A few different things. I mean, sometimes it's impulsivity. Sometimes it is figuring out how the world works and trying things out. I find a lot of times with kids who are more on the impulsive side of things, they lie as a response to not get in trouble and to get out of things that they have done. We also see it in highly creative kids. It's they're weaving stories and they're trying, it's also a little bit of social development, which is how do people respond to me if I do this? And wow, when I told that kid that I built the largest blah blah blah, they were really impressed. I think I'm going to keep that up. So it's kind of like it's just figuring things out. So I like your approach, actually. I do think most of the time in these situations is we see them as episodic or a phase as opposed to a chronic trait. And I like the, interesting, just to kind of, just let it slide. And every once in a while, you do have to reflect reality. And yeah, that's going to go against the PDA-ness. But I think in those cases, if you're being really thoughtful about it, that's just what's going to happen. It's still information that your son is receiving that's needed.
I like that neutral approach. Okay, Sue, my 7-year-old son, many symptoms of PDA, recently started to shout in public and in school when he was interrupted or frustrated, or when we told in a soft voice he's too loud, he will get even angrier and claim he didn't shout. Teachers will ask him to clear his mess on the table, and he'll shout that there's no mess. Is this an unconscious outburst or just another coping mechanism, and what should we do about it?
Well, it sounds like that he's, He doesn't want negative feedback. He doesn't want to be told what to do. And so that, I think it's impulsive that, I mean, that's a coping mechanism. He probably doesn't even believe that there's no mess, but denial is the first line of defense here. I wonder if you just wrote him a note and put a post-it note on the desk. Rather than verbally confront him, just a little called tips, and at some point during the day, say to the whole class, sometimes I want to give all of you tips to help you learn better. And so, and then you can save your tips in the tip jar, but do it with everybody, but don't make it verbal. Just leave the tip and go away. Then you're not there to receive the outburst. If the, you know, and it, you know, see what happens, but wonderful.
I like that. I just want to piggyback on that. You're making me think of so Dan Tischner, who used to be a Camp Summit counselor, and he spent several years as an educator in special education classrooms. And he would have a post-it pad and a pen with him everywhere he went. And he would, so he brought that strategy that he used in his special ed classroom to Camp Summit. And it was very interesting because if there were some rambunctious kids and they needed to, they're getting really intense, he would just write a little note and he'd put it down and it would like, they'd be curious. So they'd stop doing what they're doing and they'd look at it and they'd look at him, but it would message received. It wasn't the same sort of stimulus to fight or to go bump up against. So I've seen it in action and it was pretty effective.
It might be that you also want to give compliments or just I noticed, I noticed, gee, I noticed that you're working really well. And then tip. And another one could start with a tip. You're working very well today, but I'd like you to clear off some of the things from the desk. So if you
Nice.
use the word, the desk is messy, he can say that it's not messy. But if you say, please put the papers in your desk, he can't say they're not there. The word messy, you can do it with, but you can't do it with something very specific. And that
Yeah.
could as well.
And I'll also throw in Linda Murphy's Declarative Language Handbook. Very helpful. And we have a couple of talks with Linda Murphy. Okay, Dan, big question. Hard to do a short answer. My son is 14, and I'm wondering how I can get through to him when he's so adverse to listening and often shuts us out of his feelings.
I was expecting a long question. So it's a short question. That is a complex question.
Short question that could have a very long, I mean, we could do a whole like
Yeah,
three
no,
part seminar on this.
it's hard. I mean, we lived through this with one of ours for sure at this age. I'm reflecting and happily 10 years or 8 years later for this individual, you wouldn't even know that we went through it. So one thing is just the looking at the long haul and again, developmental phases. So this is not unusual with this age. And I think you keep trying to show, you just keep showing up. You do your best not to annoy. And I found myself writing letters on a few occasions. And when I would go into his room after a little bit after dropping off the letter, and when he was out of his room, I saw that the letter was open, read, and then put away like on the side in a place. And so it was received. And so just because you're not getting responses doesn't mean he's not listening. And the other thing is he going through something that could benefit from some outside counsel or coaching? Like, is it beyond angst and turning inward? Is he experiencing any depression? Is there, a mentor or someone else in the family, an older cousin, like anything that he is talking to? Because again, if someone is shut down everywhere, then we're really concerned. If they're shut down towards us parents, it's not all that uncommon. It's difficult, but it's not that uncommon. So I'd just be looking at that too to see if some extra resources and support could be helpful as well.
Man, I'm sensing a theme of writing things and leaving them. I'm going to call it the carrier pigeon strategy.
Nice. Yes, there is a theme developing. Yeah.
All right, cool. Moving right along. So we are on the hunt for potential good fit bridge gap year ideas. We maybe should even put this question in our Facebook group. Looking for gap year ideas for our 18-year-old 12th grade son. 2E, major EF challenges. Autism level 1, ADHD, anxiety, slow processing. Loves science, especially biology. Would love some help identifying possibilities. Can be a formal college-ish program. Already familiar with Landmark and CIP. Are there others? Or it could be something we do it ourselves, or can be something outdoorsy or totally different, not college adjacent. But both of us parents agree that our kiddo is not yet ready for a traditional 4-year full-time live on campus with roommate scenario. And I'm happy to chime in on this one too.
I think anything is possible. I mean, you identified so many things that might help. Certainly, science would be a good thing. Certainly, something that is away, so they have to experience, under supervision, but not do it somewhere else. I know Landmark, and I don't know if it's for their a gap year, but they do have a program where they're learning on a boat. I mean, they're out sailing somewhere, and it's an interesting experience that Landmark put together. But you probably did more research on this, Debbie, than I have.
Well, I just want to say, Sue, you were talking earlier about like how you frame something, how you kind of sell it to the kids. Like, this isn't work, this isn't homework, this is like a fun musical thing we're doing. I kind of took the gap year the same way. And I said, when in your life do you get a whole year to do something really cool with? The gap year is not going to be like hanging out in your room on the computer. Or even like, you could work at the sandwich shop, but I want you to think really big and have a series of collaborative conversations. Like, what is most important to you on this gap year? Do you want to travel? Do you want to earn money? Do you want to work in marine biology and do some volunteer kind of thing? Do you want to be out in the national parks? And for my son, he said the most important thing is he wanted to be with a group of people. So I said, awesome. Let's only look at things with a group of people. And many of we landed on AmeriCorps, and there was like a group of 15 people, and they traveled to 6 different projects through the course of a year. They did helping with injections for COVID. I'm not, the word's not coming to me. They did Habitat for Humanity. They did urban renewal. They did so many different cool things. So have that collaborative conversation, and it's like the opportunity of a lifetime. I'm a big advocate on gap years. Okay, and I would really encourage you to put this question in the Facebook group because we might get a lot of great ideating going. All right, not sure which of you would like to answer this one. My 8-year-old son with ADHD, who broke his leg and is still in crutches, recently told me that he was being left alone at recess inside because nobody wanted to play with him. The teacher reassured me that he was not alone and a friend had stayed with him to play a board game. I'm curious why he wouldn't tell the truth. Maybe he just wants to go outside very desperately with his classmates. The teachers reported a really poor attitude at school of late, and mean comments that the teacher said indicated an unfortunate attitude toward being part of our learning community. How do I help find out what's under this iceberg tip of lying and negative comments? Clearly, his broken leg is impacting his emotional state, which is expected. How do I also communicate with the school to help them empathize with him during this really challenging and traumatic time for him? Which of you would like to take
I think Sue wants to.
I don't know. I think you do. I think I mean, I'm wondering how he's perceiving having a broken leg. I mean, something is he being left out of so many things he really enjoys doing? Is Is he afraid? I mean, sometimes when kids come and have a cast and everybody signs it, they feel special. They get all the attention. But he seems to be reacting just the opposite, that this is really a problem to him. That's why I think Dan should answer this. I just think that something else is upsetting him, and he's dealing with it by being this negative. So I'm
Yeah, and being like an energetic young kid and having to
Right.
can't run around, can't be with your friends, that's
Not
hard.
a happy camper.
No. No, I think I'm agreeing with this. I'm thinking if he's normally a very active, social, gregarious, motor movement guy, and he can't be outside and play with all of his friends in all of the games, playing a board game even with one person, he might just be making some very overgeneralized statements. Nobody plays with me. I can't do anything. I'm left alone, because he's just summarizing the emotional experience of everyone's outside playing all the games, and he's not, and he can't. And I would say that if all of this struggle and this negative attitude that the teacher is describing is since the broken leg, then I think we have the culprit of he's really struggling with this injury, and it's really impacting his emotions and his attitude. And so I wouldn't focus on the lying. I would focus on the how do we help him re-engage? How do we help the teacher understand he's really struggling and he hasn't been himself? And, try to come up with a plan to help him get on track. I think sometimes, and this is Sue, you always talk about this, like oftentimes we're focusing on the kid when we actually need to be focusing on the environment. Like alter the environment to support him, as opposed to focus on him to change his attitude.
You just wonder if he could go outside and be the photographer. If he could be outside and even have and said that we want to actually do a photographic essay of how kids play at recess. And if he has the right kind of lens on his phone, he might not have to be running around. But if you could use this as an opportunity to keep him seeming special, not separate from the group, but providing an important role for the group. Or something the teacher really needs to have happen. Gee, I am worried about these kids. Could you watch to see if there's any arguing on the playground today? You could be my helper today and really give him a role where he can be out with the kids.
Yeah, and something that comes to mind for me is I have a friend who is in a bad accident and is now in a wheelchair for life. What is his experience about being, less physically able, and what is he feeling inside, the rejection, and that's a major experience that could affect him for life.
Yeah.
All right. Big stuff there. Sue, my 11-year-old daughter with dyslexia and ADHD has told me her teacher is sometimes sarcastic towards her in school, saying to the class that she's offering an alternative activity because we wouldn't want anyone to get upset about having to do it a certain way, and makes comments like anyone can sit still for 40 minutes. This makes her feel singled out for her accommodations. I'm looking for advice on how to help support her.
Wow, my invisible accommodation, see?
Yes, we need it. We need it.
I think if she's feeling that the teacher's saying those things, there is a message being conveyed that is just not appropriate. And if I was a parent, I would go talk to the teacher that this about really this is, she's very sensitive, and she feels that you're not believing that she needs it. I think about giving choices in a classroom so she's not singled out. This is a parent-teacher conference moment.
Yeah,
And
and let's bring
about,
the school advocacy toolkit too and talk about accommodations.
yeah, and I think you say that, I'm really getting concerned. I'm sure you don't intend, when a child is sensitive, bright and quirky, they tend to be more sensitive. And I understand, that you may not have meant this, But my daughter is taking this very personally as an affront to her abilities and her abilities and disabilities. And so I think we need to think about other ways that we could communicate because this one is not working for her. And
Right. Yeah. Okay, Dan, when do you look for, or what do you look for in diagnosing ADHD in a twice exceptional child? My son is 8 years old, dyslexic, and has periods of calm, but also moves very fast at times and seems scattered. He has asked me for a full ADHD evaluation, self-diagnosis. He believes he has trouble focusing. Any input would be appreciated. Thank you. I love when it comes from the child.
it's so great when it comes to the child. Did you say 10? Sorry?
Eight.
8. Wow. Okay. So that's not common. That shows a very high state of awareness for an 8-year-old I mean, there's teenagers we're trying to have look at this and older who will refuse to look at these issues. So first of all, this sounds like a very deep, introspective, and aware child. And we know with twice exceptionality, we often have the asynchrony of executive functioning challenges, which can be hard to pull apart with different diagnoses from just the asynchrony. We also know that in dyslexics can have attention, or excuse me, executive functioning challenges. And I would say select attentional difficulties for subjects that are very difficult for them due to their dyslexia, but it's not global attentional issues. And if he's seeming scattered and disorganized, and wants to know, if you're able to do that, it's a good thing to do. It just supports his growth, development, and understanding. Well, okay, the question was, what do you look for? So you're looking for, is there outside of his specific areas of interest, are there patterns of inattention, difficulty with organization, trouble with task initiation and completion, like across categories? Now, with dyslexia, it's interesting because reading and writing are generally harder. So that can be a factor related to dyslexia. And for some ex kids who have extreme ADHD, they even describe having difficulty focusing in their areas of interest. So it's often really complicated, and that's why we end up doing so many of these types of evaluations, because it's hard to tease apart just from classic questioning and questionnaires in these situations, because you're trying, what's dyslexic? What's gifted twice exceptional? Are there attention executive functioning issues? How much, if there are? So it's complicated. And if you have an inkling and they're wondering, regardless of age, you're wanting to find a way to support the inquiry.
Right. The person who asked the question about the 13-year-old with potential autism, there's an ex-wife who doesn't think it's autism and refuses to allow testing. You know, I think this crops up a lot, Dan, with separated and divorced parents who both need medical consent. What do you recommend in those situations?
It's very diff I mean, it's difficult. In at least in the state of California, we need consent from both legal guardians. And if one guardian refuses, actively refuses, I mean, sometimes you're not able to get a hold of them and you make a clinical judgment to move forward. But if someone actively refuses, you can't proceed. So it's very difficult, and in some cases, people go to court to get a court ruling to say this treatment needs to happen or this evaluation needs to happen. But it's a very difficult situation. Sometimes a way is when the if the child sometimes is wanting to know these things or wanting to get this help, then sometimes the child talks to the other parents and says, "Can you please support this?" But that's a difficult place for a child to be as well.
Yeah, I'm sorry you guys are struggling with this. It is difficult. Okay, Sue, my 11-year-old daughter has dysgraphia and hates physically writing. She prefers Talk to text. Is she too old for OT and should I push physical writing?
Very short. Forget physical writing, period.
And to this parent, I just want to tell you, go into our AI, Bridget, and ask your question there. Sue has answered this on a couple of occasions. She talks about the study that she's done about not asking kids to read. And we've got great information from Sue on this question, and you're definitely not alone in asking this.
There's now, if she has voice to text, she's got Siri at her fingertips all the time. As long as she's willing to put her ideas on paper in some way, that's most important. Physical writing is not something that she'll have to do. She'll be able to write lists and things that we all like to use physical writing for, but she will be ahead of the game if she can use technology to get her ideas on down on paper.
Okay, fantastic. Dan, my bright and quirky autistic 12-year-old daughter is on vacation at the moment and will be starting a new school in 2 weeks' time. The previous school, which she attended for 6 months, did not work out. She is really unmotivated to do anything and to participate in wider family activities at the moment. She doesn't really want to leave our home and just wants to do crafts or rewatch familiar TV shows at home most of the time. Should I be pushing her, forcing her to engage more with the outside world? Her grandparents, in particular, are really offended that she's so reluctant to spend any time with them. And I'll just say there is a cultural extended family kind of component with this family too.
So a few things. If school did not work last time, after 6 months, he might be in recovery mode and safety mode and feeling very comfortable at home and doing the things that make her feel secure and that are safe. Art, rewatching shows and reading books and all the things that, again, comfort. It is not uncommon for individuals with this profile to not want to spend time with people, either even in the immediate family, but especially extended family and beyond. So part of this is, in these cases, it's often trying to educate the family members, which I know can be difficult when they're grandparents with different values, different generation. About the profile, about what she's going through, and that you completely understand and want to support more time, but it's going to take time and it's very difficult for her with her profile. And that's really all you can do. I think to try to ask her, hey, could you at least spend, he's like spend 10 or 15 minutes with grandma and grandpa, and you know, they just really want to spend a little time with you. Like, you can try to get a little bit. And after that, I just think it's a delicate to dance.
Yeah, and I like that, just messaging to people. She's in a healing phase. That was really stressful, her last environment, and naming that there is this stage called recovery. Okay, great. Sue, my autistic 13-year-old son will struggle in public high school in small town Ontario next year. He's disorganized, bright, disengaged, emotionally overwhelmed socially. Currently, he has small class sizes and extra support. It will be the opposite in high school. What can I do to support him to reach his potential with limited resources as a single working mom? Big question.
Yeah, it's a small town in Ontario. Is there some sort of program that provides big brothers or big, you know, big brother program where you can have a mentor or someone, a tutor to support him? Is there a church group? Is there a local college that needs, they need field experience hours? You need to find an adult to be, to support that child. And it's not you, you're busy working and it's not good for the relationship. But you need to find someone who will have that role.
Yeah, I would add to that school clubs, and I just have to tell this really quick little story. I did a bunch of research. Minette in our community. I did a bunch of research on programs that work for learning disabilities, neurodivergent kids. And there were so few evidence-based programs, but there was one called Eye to Eye,
Oh, we
which
know
was
that.
started by our friend Jonathan Mooney. And so I know a student who had severe anxiety to the point where she was housebound, started a chapter of Eye to Eye, ended up, she was so engaged. She was nominated to go to Washington, D.C. They passed legislation on behalf of students with learning disabilities. It became this incredible thing. So, you know, look into Eye to Eye, look at different clubs, and I think that belonging will really help. And then sometimes there's executive function coaching in school and other supports. So we want to get really chummy with the school counselor and see what's available too. Okay, Dan, how can you gauge if a social emotional play group for autism is helping or inhibiting your child? My son is 7 years old. He attends special ed pullout 2 times per week and attends a weekly program outside of school. Some of the emotional interactions are intense, and I'm not sure how my son is absorbing, processing the dynamics.
It's a reasonable question to ask. Sometimes they help these groups. Sometimes it's neutral. And other times it just isn't a good fit, depending. It's so much depends on the compilation of the profiles in the group, and how your child's profile fits with that. So, I mean, one thing is you look at your child's behavior. Like, if your child getting more, like coming back dysregulated and upset after this group, and if you're having a feeling like yes over time, that's an indication this might not be this might not be helpful. Another way is to actually ask the group leaders, because it sounds like there's two groups, one in the school and one individually, how your child is interacting, how he seems compared to the other group, and do they think it's a good fit for him? You know, and doing this not in an accusatory way, of course. It's more like you're just curious. And you got to trust, ultimately, you have to trust your own instincts. Because a lot of
And
these,
Dan, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I just want to ask a little follow-up question here, because I hear from so many parents that when they go to something for kids who are all under the autism umbrella, and we have a bright child with autism that they don't necessarily feel a fit. And, you know, our diagnosing manual, the DSM, used to separate autism and Asperger's. And most of our kids in this community are Asperger's, or what we call now, you know, autism level one. And I've just heard so many times when they're grouped with the larger umbrella of autism, we get this kind of experience.
Yeah.
Is that your experience?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I think, yeah, that is a challenge for a lot of people. And let me just plug buddy matching that we're doing for members at no extra charge following Friendship Week. The form was sent to your inbox yesterday. Maybe Casey can put the form in the chat. And this is your opportunity to get it in by April 17th. And we will match your child with a group of friends, either locally or across the globe, like a pen pal. And we have almost 100 who have signed up. So very cool, guys. Very cool.
Wow.
All right.
That's great.
All right. I'm so excited to see what happens. Okay. My 8-year-old son is grieving the recent death of his father. He's in individual therapy and choosing to only go to school half days. I overheard a classmate tell my son that he has been much more annoying and in trouble at school since his dad died. My son seemed really hurt and embarrassed by the comment. Dan, how would we help our little buddy here?
And doesn't that sound like the kid heard it from the teacher who might have tried to explain to the class?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. What are you thinking, Sue?
I'm thinking that they need to talk to the teacher to find out what's going on, because in her attempt to be helpful, she might be, really, these are young kids and they don't always understand. And I think she might, I just think it's backfiring. I think so, it was, that's not what another 8-year-old child would say on their own, I don't think.
Yeah.
Not typical. I mean, it could happen. But I think that I know that they're, the teacher needs to allow him perhaps an outlet in his writing or drawing or something to incorporate, if he wanted to talk about, write about how he's feeling. I mean, quietly giving some of those classroom assignments a place where he can feel sad, but.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's helpful. Dan, anything to add, or should we keep moving?
No, I think I agree with that.
All right, great. Sue, my child, 8 years old in second grade, autism PDA dysgraphia, struggles to understand math concepts. I think he overthinks it and gets confused. He's currently in a small tutoring center. But he doesn't do the work there, so most of the work is being done at home by me. I am not a trained teacher, and I specifically struggle teaching math. Any resources or ideas would be greatly appreciated.
Well,
To the rescue.
we have Miss Math. That would be a great thing if she has room in her schedule. Let's give her that resource, but because she will wonderful online teaching concepts about math in the most fun way ever. So that would be a resource, but I wouldn't continue using that person if he's doing most of the work at home with you. That's silly. That you need to find someone else. Yeah.
That is silly. So Sue and I have a colleague named Rachel McAnallen, Miss Math. I'm going to put her website right here. She's in her 80s. She has all the enthusiasm and wit and humor you can imagine. She worked in our children's program during COVID. Okay, she's brilliant. She teaches math brilliantly. So I would connect with her, and she does tutor kids all over the world.
Right.
So that would be a good one. Okay, Dan, and I have rewarded my 13-year-old son for good behavior with a gaming PC after being sent to a wilderness treatment center and a therapeutic boarding school for the prior 4 months for school refusal and bad behavior in the home. This gaming device is something he has wanted, but I never promised it to him as a reward. I have a thought about this question.
Yeah, go for it.
Right. My thought about this question is I have a family member who went through wilderness treatment and residential treatment. I am hoping that they came out of this program with certain aha moments and certain skills. And when I've interviewed teens in this situation, typically what I hear is that they have learned to take responsibility, that the locus of control goes to them for feeling responsible to change their life. So what I would be curious to try, and we could have a collaborative conversation around this, would be, hey, buddy, you went to the treatment program, you did awesome. There are certain goals we're working on you and as a family to stay healthy, to learn these skills. And I have mixed feelings about the gaming thing, and I think that could turn some things sideways. So let's look at A, how do you earn it? By doing the work, strengthening the muscles coming out of this program, and then B, how do we also have a create an agreement about the pros and cons and what we might have to watch out for having this gaming system in our life. Dan, anything to add?
Beautiful. Beautiful. Yeah, I would. So, first of all, it's great that this process has happened. It takes a lot of work, a lot of courage, a lot of emotion on all sides, parents. And I do think it's something to put out there in the future as aspirational, but I would be concerned as well. We know how many problems happen with screens, particularly with neurodiverse folks who have trouble with regulation. So to add that right away, which would be exciting, could also introduce a lot more challenges on the reintegration. And that's such an important part is this transition plan and keeping those positive coping skills and regulation working within the family system, because it's often easier to do it in the system with all the rules and the consistency of these programs. So totally agree with what you're saying,
Okay,
Debbie.
fantastic. Fantastic. Okay, great. Dan, this is for you or me. I have a 16-year-old son who's been resistant to counseling. Are there any online games or VR games that can help with cognitive behavioral therapy?
I mean, there are a ton now. I mean, well, there is a ton of AI stuff, and it's highly dysregulated. I mean, it's not regulated yet, but there are a lot of programs that are coming out, and the research is showing, outside of the ones that are completely AI and make up their own stuff and tell you things to do that's not good for you, that these cognitive behavioral apps can be very helpful. I don't know about a virtual reality game. Do you, Debbie?
I don't. There's the Zoom app. They have a mental health thing. I would want to do a little more digging. What are the goals for counseling? What are we, it could be, do we have severe anxiety? Do we have executive function stuff? I would want to know a little bit more information. So feel free to follow up in the Facebook group with the Ask the Coaches post. And we can help you there too. All right. You guys, we are actually doing really well here. Okay. Dan, how to support perfectionist, sensitive to losing 13-year-old boy playing high-level chess with men modeling poor sportsmanship when they're the only option for in-person competitive play? Asynchronous development in several areas has been a lifelong challenge for him. What are we going to do about those
Loser.
chess playing men, Dan?
Well, yeah, that's really funny. Those are the role models. Yeah, I mean, when it comes to high performers across fields, perfectionistic tendencies or full-blown perfectionism is generally part of the package. I mean, it just, there's this drive to win. There's a fear of losing. There's a like never good enough of what have you done for me lately? Yeah, I won this, but it's so I would be focusing in on what I'm just unclear what the actual I get the profile, what the actual area that we're trying to focus in on is. Is it sportsmanship and you're trying to teach them that well, first of all, that when you compete, there's always a winner and always a loser. And so, understanding the reality of competition, helping them understand what perfectionism is and how it actually, what messages the perfectionism tells him, like, I'm
And
not
I'm
good enough.
thinking the main question here is how to be a gracious loser.
Yeah, how to be a gracious loser when all the high-level men you're playing with aren't? That's tough.
Well, tell him he needs to analyze those losers. Get into a conversation about their behavior. Did he like it? How did it make him feel? Would he want to play with this person again? Wow. What did they teach me not to do? I mean, you might have some fun with it a little bit.
I like that. I like that. Yeah. What was the energy in the room?
It's a good way. Would you want to play with him again? I think Everything, like everything I learned about losing its chess was not from my competition. I mean, you they can be funny,
Seriously, great. I love them. Okay, great. Sue, next one's for you. Looking at high school options, our neuropsych doctor said get away from public school or he likely won't ever approach and consider a neurotypical child for socialization and friendship. All right. Okay. I'm not going to add commentary. Teachers have him with the neurodivergent kids at the lunch table for staff convenience, even though he is higher function, autistic, and perfectly capable, but was bullied, so he's hesitant. He has no friends. The neurotypicals are not inclusive of the neurodivergent outside of school, and it's very concerning. The question is, can a Catholic high school, without having the IEP followed, be a reasonably safe compromise if he agrees? He has executive functioning issues and some weak learning skills in reading comprehension, but strong in all other areas. Are we able to consider private Catholic schools as a healthy choice or stay in public with the restricted social scene and have the IEP help that he gets now? I'm so porn. Thank you. ASD tape one, ADHD inattentive and rejection sensitive. I'm just going to say these black and white statements about all public schools being a certain way. Sue, I'm sure you're going to talk about how to find that environment that's going to be conducive for our unique kids.
First of all, the Catholic school, I don't know why that might be better. We don't know what that school is like. But the IEP can be implemented in a private school. That it's not one or the other.
So we're really looking when we look at these environments and maybe do a shadow day, we're wanting to ask certain questions to evaluate.
I would look first to school. I'm going to start with what is his interest area. If he's high functioning autism in that talent area, he might be the perfect fit. So if it's coding, and there's a coding club in school, the kids, some of them will be neurodivergent, some of them won't, but he'll be with his peeps. And it's not your peeps aren't defined by whether or not you're neurodivergent, gifted, or otherwise. They are by the people who like what you like, laugh at what you laugh at, and you feel comfortable with them. Forcing integration with neurotypical kids who don't meet any of those requirements is not the best solution either. You've got to find their niche, their peeps. And whatever school setting has opportunities to be with your peeps, if you will, that's what would guide me.
Love it. Love it. Okay. Fantastic. Dan, or I can take this. What is the best way to introduce my 3 and 5 year old to video games? We're extremely limited screen family, but my 5 year old is really pushing for it and we're open to it, but want to start out with a good structure. Happy to elaborate. Do you want to start, Dan?
You're the expert. You're the video game expert. So,
Am I? Oh.
yeah.
I did talk to a lot of people about this. Okay, I'm going to channel Alok Kanojia, and if you don't know Alok Kanojia, Dr. K, check out his YouTube channel, and he has a new book. And hopefully, I'll get to interview him, How to Raise a Healthy Gamer.
Oh,
Let's
that's
read the book.
great.
Yeah, let's read the book before we do anything with these 3 and 5 year olds. But he really pushes teaching skills for life. So I would, first of all, be having lots of juicy conversations with my partner, if you have a partner, about what do we want kids to get out of screens. I know when they're those ages, it's very tempting to keep them busy on screens so we can get stuff done. It doesn't sound like that's what you're doing. But we can make content choices. What's educational? What's gonna develop their skills? What's gonna expose them to music and art and science and math and all the wonderful things the internet can bring us? And I think you're very right to be wanting to do this slowly. You could start with 30 minutes a week. Your 5-year-old probably has lots of friends who have lots of ideas, and we want him to know early on different families, different rules. We might probably won't be doing things the same way as Johnny's family. And I just have to tell you a really funny story. So I was like very anti videos for my kids when they were young. And my mom, who would watch them 2 days a week, started playing them Little Einstein's videos. And my child went to preschool the next day after watching one, and they were playing music for cleanup in preschool, and he said, "Oh, that's the Bach's overture of whatever." And the teachers were like dumbfounded, and they're like, "Oh my gosh, you must be educating your children in classical music." I'm like, "Grandma put on a video, and it happened to be Little Einstein's." So, proceed with caution. There are benefits to being on the internet, and choose wisely, just as you're probably choosing their foods wisely. Okay. So, our 8.5-year-old boy with ADHD has superior verbal reasoning skills, but very weak working memory. He learns new vocabulary instantly, but cannot retain sight words despite the multi-sensory approaches we use for memorization. He gets 8 out of 10 on weekly spelling tests, but cannot spell the same words the next week. Could we continue to review over and over and over, or just let it go and be glad he lives in a digital age of voice to text and spell check?
It certainly sounds very dyslexic. That's absolutely the characteristics. They're probably for him, learning spelling rules and stuff should be more about the structure of language than memorizing a series of letters. Especially if they're bright little kids, learning root words and things like that. And it could be lots of fun. I know they do that at the Nueva school. I love how they teach vocabulary and spelling at the School for Gifted Kids in San Francisco. And the kids get to be etymologists and they do inquiry around words and it's just a different way to approach spelling. They might not remember the words. The more they use them, the more they might remember them. It's not those spelling tests weekly. There's no guarantee you remember them 3 days later. There's just not. Same thing with math facts. So if you learn how to use the dictionary, how to use the technology programs, editing programs, right now inventive spelling might be the best way to go and have AI correct your work for you. I don't know, Dan, you're the dyslexic expert.
Yeah.
I'm
How
not
old is it?
sure.
How old is this person again?
8.
13.
Oh, I thought
13.
he said
Oh, wait,
eight.
no, sorry. Wrong question. Wrong question. 8.5.
I mean, I agree with everything Sue's saying, and I think it's too early to give up on multisensory intervention. I would do everything Sue was saying, and I would just assess if it there's several different types of multisensory intervention, and there's several different types of coaches and interventionalists, and some have that magical power to really engage with children, some don't, and some it's not their fault. It's just that approach is not working for that child, depending on the level of dyslexia. So I agree with everything Sue said, and I would still be wanting multisensory intervention. Spelling. Even with good multisensory intervention, the reading improves, the fluency improves, the phonological processing improves, but often the spelling still sucks. And so I wouldn't look at the spelling. So yes, for tech spelling, writing, technology is wonderful. When someone has such high verbal reasoning, we want to increase, especially why the brain is so plastic and malleable at this age. We really would want to increase the decoding and the reading fluency. However, yes, we still have audiobooks, which is wonderful. And he might rely on for years to come. But I'd still be wanting to improve those skills.
All right, fantastic. Dan, my 13-year-old son with sensory 2E and probably mild autistic and rejection sensitivity dysphoria is bothered by lots of things, and recently by someone singing loudly behind us in church. He's normally compassionate, but he got very angry and bothered by her singing. How can I help him build his tolerance level? It causes problems with peers too. And I just want to throw in here, let's look at misophonia being on the list too, that a lot of people don't know
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
about.
For everyone, first of all, just the misophonia thing is, many of you know this, but it's the classic example is chewing at the dinner table, the food table, and there's just a screaming reaction, and it's like someone is created a cardinal sin, and you're looking around like, what? Like, this is disgusting. How do you do? So it's like this hypersensitivity to these sensory like noises and experiences, so that a lot of people have it and people don't know about it. I think in these situations, the sensory issues are real. So I don't know if it's right now about tolerance or actually about the strategy of if you're being overwhelmed, how to quietly remove yourself. I've worked with so many adults over the years who have kids with significant sensory issues, and one parent or both parent will say, "Oh, I was exactly like that. I had the same response." And then I'd say, "So what do you do now? What do you do when you're at a work event? What do you do when you're at a school event? What do you do when you're at a restaurant or a bar?" He's like, and they will, almost all of them would say, "Well, I've really, my tolerance has increased over time. I have strategies about where to stand, and I know my limits." And why not teach those to a child at the same time who's having the same experiences?
Love it. Love it. Okay. All right. The last question is for me. So I'm going to ask another question for both of you. And then you can have a little think time while I answer the last question. We have parents who, let's say they have two or three kids and they're working. They love the Idea Lab. They wish they had more time. But they really need to consolidate their learning. Whether it is getting tips or condensed things, we've been asked for key takeaways. What, in your experience, helps busy parents learn when they really want to learn, but they just don't have a lot of time? So I'm going to let that brew for a minute and answer this question. iPad is the go-to tool for driving my almost 11-year-old. We commute on weekends for 4 hours. Would love to replace mindless low-value gaming, but there is such strong resistance. Any advice for managing this? For example, work the iPad content and/or remove the iPad and replace with other stuff and accept the intense pushback both scenarios will entail. Well, I think this would be a really great opportunity for a collaborative conversation. And I would love you to express your concerns to him and for him to express his concerns to you. And then we love talking about being self-scientists and running experiments. And what experiments can you run that would be a win-win? Now, some parents might say, like, hey, you're going to be in the car for 2 hours. I'm guessing it's 2 hours each way. Just know you never get this kind of freedom, but you can have it in the car. Some parents might land there. Some parents might say, you know what? It just feels too much. You can have an hour of gaming, and then let's have some library books in there, or you could get on YouTube and do some learning. We could do a book on tape, or an Audible book. I remember he might be too young for this, but we were on a road trip and we were playing David Goggins' book, which is very like for people who are into like Navy SEALs and stuff. Our son, who normally will do his own screen on a car on a road trip, but so engrossed with the book. So I would definitely play around with Audible books. Okay. Coming back to the question, busy parents who want to learn and don't have a lot of time would love to ask the brain trust here.
I think one thing you can do is things have to be kind of something you can listen to. So when you're in the car going to work, you listen. When you're taking a walk, when you're doing the dishes, when you're folding laundry, when you're taking a shower, I think the best way to catch up is by, finding those, selecting those topics you're interested in and just using them at that time that your hands are busy. And you really need to focus on one thing, but you really can listen. And it just kind of fills the space, the intellectual space.
I am in a membership and they have a members only podcast, which makes that very interesting. And guys, for you guys listening, let me know if that would be of interest. Not that I know how to do that, but everything's figure outable. And what's your experience, Sue, with like, because you work with a lot of kids with working memory issues, like what about any takeaways or summaries or what we learned this week? Like, how do we, you buy that can of orange juice that's the concentrate that you add the water. Like, how do we concentrate things down?
Yeah, well, I there could be, I mean, sometimes at the something like this, you already have by question, you already have organized by topic, right? But you could develop a series of fact sheets that go along with if somebody's sitting during this with Dan and me, and it's not how we answered, but what were the insights? So at the end of this session, what were five takeaways? And then they could get a takeaway from each of the sessions or something like that. So somebody, or you can, it would be interesting to have people as they leave today, put your takeaway, one major thing you learned today, and then have somebody just organize those major, everybody needs
With the
one.
video clips, though. I think that's with the audio or video clips, because back to what you're saying, Sue, about listening, which I agree with, is if you have like a summary takeaway or key points or key themes, and then there's 5 minutes, but one, two to three little video clips that relate, you're getting targeted information. Because I think with the, I know I get overwhelmed when I join a group membership, because it's just so, I mean, the good ones, they give you a lot of content, but it's like too much content to do with your regular life. And then it's this overwhelm of like, well, now I'm not using it. And now there's so much I'm missing out on. It's just, it could be too much. So if there was a way to consolidate, so you just get the highlights and then you can go deeper in those areas because you have so much behind information behind those from all the years on the library, I think if people can feel they're getting the snacks that they need, and they can choose to have bigger meals if they want.
I like that. I like this. And I was talking to Sharon Celine about this. I was sitting in a Panda Express. Do you guys know Panda Express? Like the quick
Yeah.
serve Chinese restaurant. My mom loves it. She always wants me to take her to Panda Express. And I'm thinking these guys have figured out like the 10 dishes everybody wants. They move very quickly down the line. And I'm like, would you make mental health information like Panda Express? And she's like, no, because you have to do the work. So, how do we transition from the snack? Because people really appreciate our vlogs. We get lots of great feedback on the vlogs. And then how do you double click to the if you want to do the work? And feel free to chime in, community who's listening. We love co-creating the Idea Lab with you. But totally open to ideas. Sue, anything come up for you when you think of snack versus the full meal? Like going to the full meal if you want it?
I guess do it in terms of teaching adults who are busy all the time. They're getting a doctoral degree or a graduate degree. They're working. They have three kids. How do I get them to do the work? And I when it's something I want them to listen to, and it's like an hour, I tell them, do this in steps. Go do this while you're folding laundry. I tell them, do it while you're doing other things that you're doing anyway, so that it makes that thing more interesting. And then I say to them, what were your five takeaways? And then they can share it with others. So I usually do it in terms of you're going to learn anything, but then tell me what you really liked about it. So I kind of am, I'm not at the part where I just want them to look at the surface. I want them to tell me, here's the depth. Tell me what you want on the surface. I go
Yes, absolutely. Okay, wonderful. So parents, if you want to put in the chat some key takeaways, that'd be great. And Dan and Sue, we're going to wrap up. Any pearls of wisdom as we close out today's session?
It was very interesting to find out so many of the children today were 8 years old. And it occurred to me that that's a really, developmentally, that's an interesting age. Because if they're around third grade, curriculum changes, gets a little bit more difficult, gets to be very different in nature, and assumes that you need to have already mastered certain skills. And I'm wondering if it was an accident that we're seeing more anxiety around that 8-year-old time, and understand it is a big jump in school what they're demanding when they're 8 years old. They might not be ready for it. They may be asynchronous. That was
Very
my
true,
thought
very true. All
today.
right. Well, my thought is Dan's carrier pigeon methods. I'm digging those.
Leaving the notes, yeah.
Carrier pigeon. Yeah, I'm thinking about how we are so quick, many of us are so quick to go into solution problem-solving mode that we don't take enough time with the empathy and pausing to try to understand the experience of the child.
Good
And if we
point.
could just pause a little bit and think about that and think about that little human's experience, what you know and what you don't know, before just going straight into problem solving, which we have to go into, but I think we need to validate and hold some space for that.
All right, wonderful. I totally agree. Great tips coming in the chat. Thank you, parents. Sue, Dan, as always. Bring in the wisdom, the dream team. We adore you. Thank you so much. Parents, thanks for bringing all the great questions. We'll do it again next month. And thank you, everybody. Have a beautiful day.
Bye-bye.
Take care, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.